Well, hello. My name is Angele Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. I must open the show with a great big thank you to everyone who made it out to our very first live crime night last week at Off Cabot in Beverly, Mass. It was incredible. You know, we did have some hiccups in the tech, and we made it work. Thanks to those of you who stuck around and we got to talk to one another for a little while. You told me some pretty amazing things, so thank you for that. You also told me you like the idea of true crime trivia, that would be fun, so I'm working on that. And you said you liked the live case discussion, so I have more of those in the works too. And I will tell you as soon as I am able, but it was a great night. The holiday season is sneaking up on us. I did put a couple of new pieces of merch in the store, Crime of the Truest Kind related. And if you have a request for something, you can let me know. Shoot me an email, crimeofthetruestkind@gmail.com. My name is Angele Wood. This is a true crime, local history, and storytelling podcast. I write about crimes. I set the scene. I connect story themes. I talk about the things that happen here in Massachusetts and New England. This episode is about violent crime, the LGBTQ+ community, transgender women, unsolved murder, and the impact on the community. Listen with care. And always about where the events of the story take place. In episode 53, we are in Allston, part of Boston, where a brutal 1998 murder in a first-floor apartment in a populated building in a crowded area remains unsolved. I will also share the story of Chanel Pickett, who was murdered in 1995 in Watertown. And later in the show, I will speak to transgender advocate and host of a hateful homicide podcast, Mallory Jenna Robinson. When I came to the city from college, from a not that small of an area in southern New Hampshire, I was up for anything. I knew there was more for me to discover about the world and myself. The city is quieter in the summer months. But come late August into early September, that special time of year known as Allston Christmas, which has nothing to do with the actual Christian Christmas holiday of bows and bells and baby Jesuses, and everything to do with the 150,000 or so students who make a mass influx into the city's neighborhoods for school. Allston is the neighborhood of Boston that is historically known as one of the more affordable, the more populated part of the city for the college class. Rents are cheaper, landlords largely unresponsive. And if you had a September 1 to September 1 lease, or if you sublet from someone else, that meant you were hiking your stuff out at the same time as a bunch of other people. Moving trucks line the narrow streets. They are stirring. Discarded belongings are piled up along the sidewalks. Someone's trash becomes someone's treasure. Oftentimes, brand new stuff is laid out from what we have always called the rich kids who just buy new stuff when they landed at their next spot. Maybe from Long Island. That all sounds pretty cool, right? Free like new goods. Well, let me tell you the story of the infamous bed bug infestation of, well, add any year here. In a piece in Boston Magazine from 2016, Spencer Buell, who now writes for the Boston Globe, wrote, "Free stuff like futons and end tables, offbeat paintings even, or record players or decorative rugs. Free stuff hauled out of ratty, overcrowded apartments and dumped on the curb to baste in the late summer humidity. What could go wrong?" Well, exactly the same thing that has been going on for eons in Boston come fall, as bargain hunters look for inexpensive home furnishings, among the things discarded on move-in day, consequences be damned. Bed bugs. The mattress-dwelling bugs love Alston Christmas. And lest you forget just how much of the city has been populated by these things, the Globe's Matt Rosciello put together a gross map using city data. Apparently, I love data. Or data. I say the word differently every time. Bed bugs are such a phenomenon in Boston. Right behind Starrowing, second reference, now you have to Google that for fun. There's a full-on offensive. Former Boston Globe writer Matt Rosciello, who went on to work as a spotlight reporter for the Boston Globe and won a 2021 Pulitzer Prize in investigative reporting, this is his hard-hitting news on bedbugs. Matt created a map using city data for every formal bedbug complaint that was made. In the 6 years of data, at the time of his reporting, there were 1,822 formal complaints from those afflicted. I have to wonder, though, what do you do about a bedbug complaint? You can't arrest the freeloading creatures. I kid, of course. These types of things need to go to the Board of Health. There is a bedbug protocol. Each school should have one. The City of Boston has a handy PDF, and mass.gov has a full page of directives, as does masslegal.org. Working in radio, we had a number of interns come through. I recall one in particular who worked on our morning show. They went to Emerson. No, BU. I don't remember. They were living in the Alston-Brighton area. Anyway, an interesting person. Most of the radio interns were. This one told the entire morning show crew that their nickname was Bedbugs. Yeah, we recoiled a bit and didn't want them getting the coffee that day. Boston, with its many colleges and universities, is a revolving door of fresh-faced students in those bedeviling bugs. Be warned, nothing else mattress. Boston is a city of neighborhoods. It's a big, small town. I've said that before. The city of Boston is represented by a collection of neighborhoods. Alston is one of those, sometimes called Alston / Brighton. Fall in Boston's neighborhoods is bustling. Crowded bus stops, full subway cars, no seats at the bar, and long lines at the coffee shop. The afternoon of November 28th, 1998 would be a little quieter. It was the Saturday of Thanksgiving break, and the throngs of students had mostly dispersed to their respective hometowns, and not only in Long Island. Although Rita Hester would usually go home too, this year she decided to stay and spend the holiday in Alston. Rita was 34, soon to be 35. Her birthday is November 30th, and this year she would have celebrated her 60th birthday. What a party that would be. She was, as it goes, living her best life. After all, it had vastly improved since moving to Boston from Hartford. She had her own place, a cat, a boa constrictor, who I recall hearing one person say they knew Rita because she bought her snakes food at their store. Growing up in Hartford, Connecticut, as one of five children, she was Rita from an early age. No quotes. Her sister Diana told NBC News in a story from July 2020 that there was never a time in her life when she wasn't Rita. Rita in quotes in this piece. Diana could never place a particular coming out trans moment for her. They seemed to just know. Her entire family embraced her transition. Rita did not get the same acceptance in her hometown of Hartford. And Diana Hester said in Hartford, people got assaulted and they got hurt. In the 1980s, there was no conversation about being gay. People were shunned and misunderstood, and worse. There was definitely no conversation about being transgender. What that was, or what it meant. And a lot of horrible things were said and done to people like Rita. Rita had a big personality and with that came many friends. If you hear anyone refer to her, she was pure joy to be around. Her energy. Reverend Irene Monroe described her as ebullient, glamorous, a sister diva friend with attitude, sassiness, and style. That she was. Tall, statuesque, 6 feet 2 inches, captivating, really. And people knew who she was. I have friends who knew Rita, and it's all the same. How much fun she was to be around, how much energy she had. I was getting into the rock scene at the time, from about 1997 on. And if I had met Rita, I would have remembered her. After she met people in Boston, she began to make the hour and a half trip by bus or car, 3 hours by train, to come up for visits. Her circle of friends began to grow, and sometime in her 20s, she made the move to Boston, feeling hopeful that she could transition more freely. Rita found comfort in community, and she became a part of the city's vibrant rock scene. Boston in the 80s and 90s, well, those were the days. The Rat in Kenmore Square in Boston proper was both famous and infamous. It's long gone today. In Alston, where Rita would find a place to fit in. Alston was named after the artist and poet Washington Alston, a Harvard and Royal Academy of Arts educated Alston. He is said to be the first important American romantic painter. In Alston, to live with 7 other roommates in a beat-up house off Brighton Ave, well, that is a rite of passage. Alston Rock City. The heartbeat of the music scene for a very long time, where artist life and student life converge. All of the many wonderful things that makes Alston, Alston. The Kells, long gone. But anyone who has come through, maybe BU or BC, you gotta chuckle off that one. Mainstay of the neighborhood, O'Brien's Pub. In business since 1984, and still there today. Great Scott, down the street on Comm Ave, became a beloved venue, only to be kicked out by the landlord during COVID. New site TBD, Carl? Bunratty's was the spot. Dive bar, turn rock and roll club, but always a dive bar. Loads of bands would eventually play there. Abel Harris, a favorite of the club. He was shot and killed in 1987. I covered his story in episode 20 with the club's former manager, David G. Bunratty's became the poorly named Melody Lounge. And when I say poorly named, I mean this. It was named for where the deadliest nightclub fire in history started, Coconut Grove, on November 28th, 1942, that resulted in the deaths of 492 people. Why would you name a club after that? It then became Local 186, named for its address, 186 Harvard Ave. Then, Wonder Bar. Now, it is some turd burger named Han. I honestly cannot tell you what it is. VIP table service, DJ booth, girls stand in line in the freezing cold without coats on place. I know this. I'm not their demo. Rita was a fixture in her neighborhood straight bars. An unlikely place for a black trans woman? Not really, no. The legend of Bunratty's sordid history lives on. And how I love to hear the stories about Oasis and back alley fights. Rita was also a familiar face among the city's gay bars. She was as comfortable performing with drag queens as she was jumping on stage with Nashville Pussy at a rock show. Rita was not afraid to be seen. Someone commented on a Facebook thread, and it said, "No night was complete without seeing her. Such a loss." Rita was a regular at Jock's Cabaret. Oh, and she could put on a show. It's Boston's iconic gay bar in Bay Village, the oldest show bar in all of Massachusetts. It opened in 1938, and Jock's became a gay bar in the mid-1940s. it has survived the rapid decline of brick-and-mortar gay clubs. Of course, there's a lot of action online, via apps, and so on. And there are a lot of theme nights in different venues around town. But there were a good amount of clubs in the 1990s. One I tried like hell to remember. Bear with me as I toss this one out to some locals or former locals who might be listening. It was in Bay Village, I believe. Kind of fancy, like a small theater or a ballroom. I narrowed it down to maybe The Loft, Chaps. This was all with the help of some friends on Facebook, so please message me if you know what club I am talking about. Definitely Back Bay, Bay Village area. That's where Club Cafe is. Open since the early 80s. Machine is gone. Ramrod. Fritz. Paradise, the Cambridge one, gone. Playland was wiped out. Gone the way of the Combat Zone. Jock's Cabaret, to their great credit, is still standing. Drag and karaoke, sure. But where are the sloppy, drunk interrupters who want to Instagram everything for their hashtag misses, hashtag bride-to-be, hope just gonna go? Dick's Last Resort closed. R.I.P. margarita buckets and actual penises drawn on your hat. Jock's is like an old friend. And people on staff then spoke of Rita, including a bartender named Johnny Frieda, who had been a bartender there since 1973. He remembered her well. He said she was a happy person. She would get up and dance. She was out for good times. There was also cause for worry that their beautiful, fearless friend could find trouble in straight bars. They had every reason for concern. 3 years earlier, a young black trans woman named Chanel Pickett was killed. On November 20th, 1995, Chanel Pickett, a 23-year-old black transgender woman, was killed brutally. She was found in the bedroom of a Watertown man who, well, we'll get to him. Much had changed for Chanel in the year leading up to her death. Chanel and her twin sister Gabrielle both lived as transgender women and had so from a very young age. Sometime in the early 1990s, they appeared on the Jenny Jones TV show. They were also on Geraldo, I learned. And of course they were. Daytime talk shows predated YouTube, and that's where you had to go to watch people being exploited for ratings. Now people are exploited for clicks and views. From upstate New York, the Pickett sisters were abandoned by their mother after she learned they were different, in quotes. That word grandmothers speak softly to each other when they talk about other people's kids over gin rummy. The sisters moved to the Boston area and lived in Chelsea. Both Chanel and Gabrielle had steady jobs. They were working for 9X, the telephone company that served 5 New England states, excluding Connecticut and add New York, supporting themselves, living a regular life. That was until someone decided to out them at work. According to Gabrielle, in early 1995, the sisters were working at 9X in the sales department in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Then, they were both transferred to a Braintree sales office. After 1 month, Chanel switched to the MIS department, reporting to a manager named Deborah Shea. Shortly after starting in that new department, she got the vibe that her new supervisor didn't like her, and she began to feel harassed. Chanel and Gabrielle talked about it, and although she was taking some hateful abuse, Chanel really wanted to work in MIS, so she tried to roll with it. But not long after, she was told from a friend at work that it was her manager, Shay, who was spreading word that Chanel was a pre-op transsexual. This is from a site called Gender Talk, by the way. We must remember that the language around gender issues was very different then. Chanel spoke with Shay's supervisor, Jane Tessier, about the situation. Tessier was equally as unsympathetic and sided with the supervisor lady. The harassment continued and the gossip mill built, and about 6 weeks after the conversation with Tessier, Chanel was fired. Gabrielle left the company 1 month later. This is why we have HR people. I had a manager say to me once that work is not a safe space. I bet a man told her that. And she was bad at her job, even though she thought she was really good at it. Former manager, I quit. They were scared, humiliated, emotionally exhausted, and running out of money. Finding new work became even more difficult. They faced a great deal of discrimination since they were outed by their prior employer, an all too familiar story in the trans community. She was normal, easily passing as a woman, important for those with real transphobia. She did try the proper channels for help at her job, but she was ignored. Chanel tried legitimate ways to earn a living. She ran out of options for survival, and hopelessness set in. It was enough for her to take risks she normally would not have. On their own, with no family support, the descent into poverty was swift. Many trans folks in similar situations turn to sex work. The oldest profession, they say. But our sexuality is a currency we have. There is incredible vulnerability. Losing her job was evidence that she was not safe. There were no protections for her. An utter heartbreak would follow. Violence against the gay and transgender communities was escalating, both nationwide and in Boston before Chanel died. The language was very different. Most headlines included terms like transvestite and transsexual, and worse. The term pre-op shows up a lot. Murdered trans folks were also referred to as it. So dehumanizing. So what happened to Chanel? On November 19th, Chanel and her sister met a man named William C. Palmer. I said his name because it is important for me to let people know that he is responsible for what happened to Chanel. The sisters met him at the Playland Cafe. I mentioned it already. It was a popular club at the time, the oldest gay bar in the city then. It opened in 1937 and closed in 1998. Playland was known to have a lot of transgender patrons. You did not go there not knowing you were where you were. You dig? And Palmer was a Playland and Jock's regular. The trans women in the community knew him. He dated trans women. Palmer was 35 and working as a computer programmer at Unisys. There was one in Cambridge, I found out. But they no longer operate in Massachusetts. He shared an apartment with roommates in Watertown. On the night of November 19th, 1995, the three of them left Playland and went to the sisters' place in Chelsea, where they drank and did a little coke that Palmer had gotten at Playland earlier that evening. I'd venture a guess that Palmer had motives to get with the two women. Just a hunch. Chanel and Palmer left and went to his place in Watertown. It was not a date, I don't believe. She was not working. The account that I have read said that she may have liked the guy. So if true, one of my theories that his rage was so he didn't have to pay for sex, well, that's out. So here's the earmuffs part of the show. The line from Old School where Vince Vaughn tells his kid to cover his ears because he's about to say something awful, earmuff it for me. Because she is not able to tell us, only her killer could testify in court that he and Chanel smoked crack at his apartment. Chanel began to perform oral sex. When then and only then he discovered that she was transgender and demanded she leave. That's his story. Chanel flew into a cocaine-induced rage and began screaming, and he gave her a jab. His claim then is he went to sleep after smoking a bunch of coke, as one does. And when he woke up, Chanel was dead. Palmer's roommates heard him come home sometime after 3 a.m. on the morning of November 20th. They did not hear anything unusual until around 5 in the morning, when they were jolted awake by the sounds of a struggle and shouting. The sounds intensified with blood-curdling screams pounding on the wall. The roommates heard a voice become muffled and gradually diminished. Two roommates knocked on Palmer's door asking if everything was okay. Palmer told them in a very calm voice, "I've got a crazy bitch in here, but I got it under control." They tried to open the door, but it was blocked, and they were unable to see inside the room. Things quieted down, and the roommates tried to go back to sleep. Sleep? After all that? Is this something that happens all the time? About 4 hours later, Palmer told the roommates, "We've got a problem." And he called his lawyer. Nobody made any move to check on this person in the room. Palmer wasn't able to see his lawyer until after lunchtime. Nobody checked on her. Nobody offered aid. No one did anything. So Chanel lay there on his bedroom floor for hours. Once he and his roommates discussed the events of that morning with the lawyer reportedly called the police, telling cops they could find a dead body in his room. Chanel was murdered by William C. Palmer. He used the gay panic defense, or in this case, the trans panic defense, which, according to the American Bar Association, is to seek to partially or completely excuse crimes such as murder and assault on the grounds that the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity is to blame for the defendant's violent reaction. And you may be surprised to know that Massachusetts remains the only New England state that does not prohibit the use of legal defenses claiming the victim's sexual orientation and or gender identity contributed to the defendant's actions. William C. Palmer preyed on trans women. Witnesses testified at trial that he frequented bars in the gay scene to pick them up. To clarify, okay, two consenting adults. He's into trans women. Lots of people are. But he used the trans panic defense to get out of murder. Oh, and he also said that cocaine was to blame. So which was it? When the medical examiner testified, this was the only way Chanel could speak, through the massive injuries to her body. She did have cocaine in her system, but far too low of an amount to have contributed to her death. The ME told the jury that she was throttled, in quotes, for at least 8 minutes. The Boston Globe referred to her as he again and again. Her face was beaten and something was stuffed down her throat. Bedding, it was believed. Gabrielle Pickett testified that she and her sister met Palmer at the Playland Cafe the night of the murder. Palmer gave them a ride to their place in Chelsea, where they snorted cocaine. One report suggested he was hoping for sex with both women. It did not happen. Chanel left with him for Watertown. In a tape statement to the police, Palmer said he put his hand over her mouth and grabbed her throat. But Chanel bit his finger. Palmer gave her what he called a quick jab to the jaw, sat on her for about 10 minutes, and then went to bed. Then Palmer gave a shrug with, "I don't know what happened," and then suggested she overdosed on cocaine. Gabrielle had to identify Chanel's body. She said her face was so badly beaten, it looked like she had been beaten by more than one person. I believe one of the quotes was, "It looked like she got hit by a truck." Despite strong physical evidence against Palmer, he was convicted only of assault and battery and sentenced to 2 years in jail. Judge Robert A. Barton acknowledged the particularly vicious nature of the killing. The LGBTQ plus community was incensed over the verdict, over the way the media wrote about transgender people, about how Chanel was vilified and at fault for her own death, while the man who killed her was portrayed as an average Joe, an upstanding member of his community, and taken by a transsexual on the grift. Chanel was just a black transgender woman. Society chose to find no value in her. A Boston Herald front page story at the time described Palmer as a polite, white-collar professional who reacted the only way any self-respecting, red-blooded, hetero dude guy would. All it said of the dead person was that she was a transsexual prostitute. Not even an ounce of compassion was shown to Chanel Pickett. And trans activists believe that the jury was affected by their own prejudice and not the evidence in the case. It is believed that Gabrielle Pickett died. I have seen it mentioned in a number of places. When is not known, or how, of a drug overdose or murder, it is not clear. In 2003, she was lost after Chanel died. I dug as deep as I could go, and if I'm even warm, there is a Gabrielle Pickett buried at the Hart Island Project. That's New York City's 131-acre cemetery on Hart Island in the Bronx, where the city buries unclaimed and unidentified people. If it is Gabrielle, She died on March 24th, 2003, at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. She was 30 years old. The details, well, they do line up. I'll be right back. Please support Crime of the Truest Kind, and there are a number of ways to do so. Listen to the show. Tell your friends about it. Share it on social media. Leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Go to the merch store. Buy some merch. Drop a tip in the jar. Give the dogs a bone. Really, my dogs are obsessed. Become a patron on Patreon, with 4 tiers starting at just $1. All links at crimeofthetruestkind.com. On Saturday, November 28th, 1998, Rita Hester spent part of the afternoon at one of her favorite hangouts, The Silhouette. This would be on my map of things to do when you are in Boston. Hit up some of the dive bars around town. The Model is just up the street, another favorite hang for Rita. The Silhouette earned Best Dive Bar by Boston Magazine, and a now-defunct Improper Bostonian. A favorite stop for locals, college students, and a fair amount of passers-through. It opened on Brighton Ave in Allston in 1965. The warmth of its neon signs, the charm of its dart room, its pool table. Friend or foe can enjoy a cheap beer or two. The Sill has had a resurgence. Been booking rock shows thanks to I Book Things. And any Silhouette diehard can get a hot dog a day for life. All you gotta do is get a tattoo that clearly represents the iconic dive, and may you never go hungry. Is there still free popcorn? That morning, Rita played racquetball with her friend Brenda. They made a plan to hang out later that night to watch figure skating. The two best friends first met at Bunratty's in the early 1990s, where Brenda worked the bar. Brenda watched the reaction of the barflies when Rita walked in, so she gave her an even warmer welcome. Weeks passed before they saw one another again, but they would become very close. Rita even spent the Thanksgiving holiday with Brenda's family just 2 days earlier, the first Thanksgiving that she had not been with her own family. At 4 o'clock, Rita called another friend, a trans woman who lived in Allston, who remained unnamed in this news story because she still felt unsafe. Rita was headed to the Silhouette, aka the Sill. That friend had a little disco nap and headed out to meet up with Rita until she saw her street blocked off by police. She immediately knew something very bad had happened. Rita's friend Brenda dozed off. Rita hadn't shown up. But Brenda just thought Rita met someone at the Sill and forgot to call her. It happened. She didn't give it a second thought. What she would find out about her dear friend was far more grim. A report states that Rita was last seen by friends at the Silhouette about 5 p.m. Around 6 p.m., someone entered her first floor apartment and attacked her. Neighbors would call the police about a disturbance. What I have been able to piece together through various reports, the call came in around 6:12, and police officers were dispatched 7 minutes later. The neighbor would tell Rita's sister that they took a long time to enter her apartment when the back door was open. When they finally got to Rita, she was bloody and badly injured on the floor. She had been stabbed over 20 times in the chest, but she was alive. It was a gruesome scene. The phone had been ripped from the wall. A partial shoe print was seen in the bloody floor. It was not Rita's. There was blood everywhere. Rita fought for her life. She almost made it. It took an hour between the time the police were dispatched and when the ambulance took her to Beth Israel Hospital. She died of cardiac arrest. Rita Hester was listed as a male by the name of John Doe. A former Logo reporter, Kate Sosin, filed a public records request in 2020, but the Suffolk County DA's office under Rachel Rollins denied the request, stating, "Although this murder occurred in 1998, this case remains open today and is currently being investigated." Accordingly, the records sought fall within the investigatory exemption to the public records, and the office denies the release. Dated March 3rd, 2020. Unfortunately, the same reporter kept referring to the silhouette as the satellite in the piece they wrote for NBC News. We know there was no sign of forced entry at Rita's apartment, that the suspect or suspects fled through the back door. It is not believed she walked in on a robbery. She was still wearing her jewelry, and nothing was taken. Money and other valuables were left behind. Did she leave the silhouette with someone? She had boyfriends. Her main guy, as told by her friend Brenda, was named Bobby, a white guy with blonde hair. Bobby was around, and then he wasn't. Nobody knows much about Bobby or where he went after Rita died. And no one is certain what their relationship was. Rita was very private about that part of her life. Neighbors told Rita's sister, Diana, that they saw two white men leave Rita's building just after 6 o'clock that night. Was one Bobby? Don't know. The family was left to do the crime scene cleanup themselves. Police do not do that. When the Hester family got into Rita's place 3 days after the police had searched it, they found a number of things that the police could have used as evidence. Rita's sister Diana said the family found $400 in a vase. That was overlooked by police. Rita's siblings and her best friend Brenda cleaned the apartment with the hope of sparing their mother Kathleen of the violence her child endured. Even at almost 35, you are still your mama's baby. Kathleen Hester was there during the cleaning up, and she found a bloody sandal. Diana Hester told NBC News she didn't think the police did enough early in the investigation. As of 3 years ago, police are still investigating Rita's murder. Someone has gotten away with it for 25 years. Did you see something that late afternoon? What do you know? What did you hear? If you have any information on this case, please call 800-494-TIPS. It's Crime Stoppers. Text the word TIP, T-I-P, to 27463, which spells out the word crime. Of course, this will all be posted at crimeofthetruestkind.com and in the show notes. Boston media outlets like the Globe and the Herald newspapers referred to Rita as a transvestite, as a man who sported long braids and preferred women's clothes, and as someone who was living an apparent double life. There was no double life for Rita. She often performed under the name Rial, but she was 100%. Both papers used male pronouns, even though everyone in the community had known Rita only as a woman for years. When transgender advocates protested this misreporting, the Boston Phoenix, the rainbowiest flag-waving alternative newspaper with its own LGBTQ radio show, their reporter scolded them for putting the paper under the political correctness microscope. Is Rita Hester's murder being eclipsed by the transgender community's grammatical agenda? Their headline asked. The same reporter, Sarah McNaught, made it a point to describe Rita's breasts and genitals. What is worse, the New England gay and lesbian newspaper, Bay Windows, the gay paper, no disrespect, that's how we knew it. The one we could expect to lead the way in reporting with sensitivity, repeatedly used male pronouns and deadnamed Rita throughout their writing. Bay Windows, the gay paper, doubled down and published sensationalizations, stereotypes about black trans women, and many mischaracterizations. Rumors were rampant about blackmail and drugs, but nothing came of those things. Rita was so beloved by everyone who knew her. The things Bay Windows printed, it was the first time that many people who knew Rita even had heard her referred to in such a way. Others would come to learn about her being transgender. I went in and read the Bay Windows reporting, which was definitely problematic for the paper of the LGBTQ plus community. In fact, when you go to baywindows.com, the header reads, "Serving New England's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities." they are not all grouped into one. And Sue O'Connell, who later became the co-publisher, is wonderful. We worked together at WFNX, where Sue, along with Keith Orr, Keith, also delightful, hosted 1 in 10, the only show of its kind on the radio at the time in Boston, focusing on issues relating to the LGBTQ+ community. So I was surprised at the tone and nature of the reporting. Bay Window's editor at the time, Jeff Epperly, triple downed. Oh, and he heard it. One letter entitled Editorial Insensitivity read in part, "First of all, if you are going to be the editor of a newspaper directed at the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community, you are going to stand on the cutting edge of social change whether you like it or not. If you want to clutch your copy of the AP style book to your bosom and declare it your one true love, you'd be better off working for, say, the Boston Business Journal, Better Homes and Gardens, or even the South End News." Boop. Oh, there are more just like that. This is happening at the very same time the world is reporting on the murder of Matthew Shepard a month earlier in Wyoming. A case driven by Matthew's sexuality as a motive. His murderers also tried with the gay panic defense. There was a difference in that reporting, though. The LGBTQ+ media began to recognize differences between the reporting on Matthew Shepard's case and the treatment given to the increase in transphobic violence. Rita Hester became a symbol for all trans people who were killed for failing to meet social expectations and gender norms. Slowly things changed. In the early 2000s, the Associated Press developed new style guidelines for reporting on transgender people. Houston activist Monica Roberts attributes this change to Rita's case, which she calls the catalyst for the media's piecemeal evolution on trans issues. Even today, with the rise of transgender visibility, many media outlets continue to make the same mistakes in reporting. How fucking hard is it? The death of Rita Hester and her treatment inspired transgender activist Gwendolyn Ann Smith into action. Gwendolyn created the web project called Remembering Our Dead to honor transgender homicide victims. The following year, they founded the Transgender Day of Remembrance with marches honoring victims in Boston and San Francisco. Now, the Trans Murder Monitoring Report has been released every year since 2008. Since the project began 15 years ago, they have recorded more than 4,600 deaths. There's more data in the show notes at crimeofthetruestkind.com. Transgender Day of Remembrance, TDOR, is Monday, November 20th. My guest, Mallory Jenna Robinson, a transgender and HIV advocate based in Los Angeles, the host of a Hateful Homicide podcast, and founder and instructor for Trans Excellence Academy, where transgender empathy training is available. We can learn, support, collaborate, and advocate. This is our conversation. You are yourself a podcaster. Let's talk a little bit about how you decided to bring this to the masses via your own podcast, A Hateful Homicide.
So A Hateful Homicide was created back in 2021. It was launched on TDOV, which is Trans Day of Visibility. And that is March 31st of every year. And so as a transgender and HIV healthcare advocate, not only of the lived experience, but also the professional experience, I would connect with community members throughout the Los Angeles County regarding, you know, violence and murders and like the fact that there was like a lot of misgendering and misrepresentation. And a lot of them would be like, you know, "Miss Mallory, can you, you know, like, we just wish someone would represent our cases accurately." And though they never like pushed it for me to do it, I just felt this instant calling and gel where I was like, yeah, you know, this needs to be told accurately and correctly, yeah, and given the victims a voice. And so, you know, on March 31st, 2021. I launched the first episode, and I literally like launched it from my phone, spoke into it, and did the first episode. And it fortunately was very well received, and it has been well received. So now we're in season 5 and just continue to grow and glow. And it's mm-hmm. the only podcast that focuses on the trans community, for my transgender community, non-binary, intersex, and two-spirit communities. And we cover cases not only in the United States, but also abroad.
So I've been doing a great amount of research on a woman named Rita Hester,
yes.
who was living her life full on as a trans woman in the city of Boston, in the rock and roll community, which is my world. And I never met Rita. She was killed in 1998. But I know a lot of people who knew Rita. And, you know, we always talk about when someone passes, like they lit up a room and they were, she did all of those things. Like that was who she was.
Yes, she was.
And her murder is unsolved all these years later. And we know that Rita has an instrumental part in what Trans Remembrance Day is. And then in researching Rita's case, I learned about a woman named Chanel Pickett. And oh my, that was a whole separate can of worms rabbit hole that I got into. So I learned a lot about these two women who are from my area, Boston area. And all of the things that I found out, I knew, but the way that their cases were represented was so dehumanizing. You know, male pronouns never gave them the respect at all. And you know, friends would say, you know, they this wasn't a double life. This wasn't them secretly doing this. This is how they lived all the time. And Chanel and her twin sister, Gabrielle, both twins, both came out as transgender to their mom. They were probably in their early teens. And their mom was, as unfortunately a lot of parents are, didn't know what to do about it. And what I have found in my research is that so many of the public, really all of the publications, including the Boston publication that is part of the LGBTQ plus community at the time, you know, certainly our language has changed since then. It was the gay paper, right? But even Bay Windows, and I'm okay calling them out because this was a long time ago and they really have had a lot of room to improve. But even a newspaper that served this community was defending the language that they used in Rita's case, making up rumors about this woman, none of which they could actually prove that she was doing any of these things. She was living her life. Are we doing better? Because this is so disappointing to read these stories about two of so many other women and folks like them.
And Joe, that's a really good point. I would honestly respond and say we have done a lot better. For sure, in terms of our messaging, in terms of like reclaiming language, in terms of making sure that like our trans community members are being accurately identified in the media, especially in terms of contemporary, like modern times. I mm-hmm. will admit there's this concern, which I see both ends. But one of the things that has been, especially in Los Angeles County within the past couple of years, has been if a trans woman particularly or a trans man has been murdered, they have been referred to just as, you know, a man or a woman. And so then again, we're still losing that messaging of the specific gender identity. And of course, while we're so grateful for that inclusive language and just seeing people as people, we want to also understand that these particular victims are not of the cisgendered experience, right? These are not cisgendered individuals who have been murdered by partners or missing or, you know, unsolved cases. These are people of the trans community. And so we need to understand that there is a different journey and mm-hmm. acknowledge that and tell that story. So while there is this inclusiveness of using man and woman at binary language to represent our trans folks, it's still almost like this fear of saying the word trans. Yeah, you know, because we're starting to see a lot of that in schools, right? Don't say gay, don't say trans. Yeah, so yeah, we're seeing where people are like, okay, well, we want to be inclusive, so we won't say trans, but we'll still just say man and woman, but then we're still losing that messaging. There is still a lot of work to go. Unfortunately, back in 1995, when Chanel Pickett was murdered, and we still don't even know what happened to Gabrielle. There's been rumors that she was murdered, or either she just, like, is, you know, underground, you know, but mm-hmm. in my heart, I do think that she was too met with a hateful homicide as well. And you know, just my spirit of spirits, I just, a lot of times we know so many, a lot of missing folks won't typically stay missing, especially when you have people who really care for you. Just would not want to do that to your loved ones. And her losing her sister, I just couldn't imagine her like having her loved ones constantly wonder what happened to her. So I do think, unfortunately, like a lot of our cases, these crimes happen and we just don't know what happened unless someone speaks up and says something. But Chanel Pickett's case specifically, it's interesting that you mentioned her because her date, it's interesting, Rita Hester is how T-Dor started. Mm-hmm. But Chanel's death date is actually how we... You see that? So Chanel died on November 20th of 1995, and Rita Hester was murdered on November 28th. But we associate T-Dor with that November 20th, which aligns with Chanel Pickett. But again, that was lost with Chanel, which is interesting enough because she was on national television, as well as her sister both, right? So they were known and everything. So I do think there was this effort to kind of find a balance between Chanel and Rita's cases by putting that November 20th. But acknowledging that Rita's death was kind of like that straw that broke the camel's back, especially because hers remained, Chanel's was, you know, was unfortunately, it was solved, but the perpetrator, you know, a cis white man who strangled her to death just did not, and we won't even say his name, but just didn't feel the need to, unfortunately, justice had in her favor. So I think that's also why they're willing to honor her.
When we talk about that case, I'm sure he's probably still alive. And I've tried to find out whether that person is still alive. Just out of curiosity, what is your life like since you got away with murder? But that person, like so many others, and we saw it with highly publicized case of Matthew Shepard, whose anniversary was very recent in October. Rita's murder was a month after Matthew Shepard. So the height of the media frenzy about these, the subject matter, it was like at 11 or, you know, 15, right? And we see that in Matthew's case, I know the perpetrators of Matthew's case tried the gay panic defense. I think the state of Wyoming, to their credit, said, we don't accept that. And I know that the person who murdered Chanel also tried the trans panic defense, as we can call it, and got away with that in not so many words. I realized that the state that I live in Massachusetts, they still allow that. The only state in New England that allows it. I don't think they have laws. Maybe you can help me with this language. I don't think a lot of states have laws against it. They just don't allow it.
That is correct. Absolutely, Angel. You know, unfortunately, there is not a lot of legislation that has been put into place to still uphold, you know, hate crimes, hate violence and incidents, especially towards specific community members, especially those of the gender identity community members. So we see one of the few states still to this day, I would say, that has those protections is Colorado. And we saw the first case to like really pinpoint that was in 2009 with the hateful homicide of Angie Zapata, a 19-year-old trans Latina woman. And that guy as well, he was the only one, still a few of them, where he was convicted of a hate crime. And there was another one in 2015 of a white trans woman as well. She was 17 years old, and it was a Latin King case, and it was on one of my episodes. And her case in Mississippi was one of those where they were also pushing for that hate crime, but still had that backlash and push like, well, it's not really on the books. So there's been these like prosecutors who have tried to like find these loopholes and try to go through the federal means as well, but then still get a lot of that state pushback. So it's very common in jail, unfortunately.
Here we are. Really days away, as you and I are speaking, Mallory, we're days away from another Transgender Remembrance Day. How can we advocate? So I say this to people. We have a lot of armchair advocates, which it's okay. I'll take it. How can we be allies and or both advocates for the community? If we can't go out in person and put our advocacy into action, what are some of the things that we can tell people or share with people that they can do, even some of the smallest gestures, but can be really effective?
That's a great question, Angel. You know, there are several ways that you can always offer your support. We have those who are going to be like our allies, you know, those who are going to always like, you know, support us from afar, but we also have our accomplices. And those are kind of like our grassroots frontliners are out there marching, picketing, protesting, speaking up. So there's always different levels of like showing up looks like. You know, one of the most beautiful things that people can do, it's all for a kind word. Mm-hmm. If, for example, if you are a social media user, feel free to go and check out some people of the trans experiences, TikToks, Instagram. Mm-hmm. You never know who your story may be, you know, they may need like a just a loving word. And just say, I'm here for you. I support you. You're seen. You're valuable. Just even commenting on a random stranger who is of the trans experiences profile can even touch them. They could be feeling so lonely. There's such a high suicide rate in jail. Mm-hmm. So those little actions as well. Also being willing to display graphics as well, right? You know, having your pride flags, having those things around, being able to utilize statements like, hi, my name is, and my pronouns are. Showing that you're willing to be affirming and meet people where they're at as well. All of those little opportunities, talking about a hateful homicide, you know, letting people know that this podcast exists, that there is a podcast for our trans community members. I had someone reach out to me of the trans experience, and it was like, I had no idea that this podcast existed. Like, I was looking into a case about Amanda Milan, and then, like, I saw that there was, like, an actual beautiful story told about her, and that's, like, so those things to make sure that people know that, yes, there are people out here of the lived experience, but also allies and accomplices who are willing to say the names respectfully and correctly. Show support.
What are your plans for November 20th this year, Mallory?
It's interesting that you brought up, you know, Matthew Shepard in terms of, you know, the correlation of the media representation and how there wasn't much for Reed or it was inaccurately. And so I actually did a TDOR 25 mission for the city of West Hollywood highlighting Chanel, highlighting Rita so people can understand their names. Also where I work at with Equality California, that organization that does like a lot of outreach and legislation, we're actually doing a special post tribute to Rita Hester for TDOR 25. I know technically the day was officially launched in 1999, but I just, you know, Rita was murdered in 1998. So for me, I cited as TDOR 25. Yeah. So those are some things. One of the things that I did want to add to really quickly in jail was one of the cases that also gets lost too is James Byrd. So one, I'm going to do a special hateful homicide show, which is coming out on November 20th, and it's going to be called 1998, the year of hate. And it's going to discuss James Byrd, who was murdered in September of 98, Matthew Shepard, October of 98, and Rita Hester. And we're going to look at all their intersectionalities and how each case was, it's almost like a historiography, but then also delving back into like why that year in particular, 25 years ago, was there such a high prevalence of violence, even 35 years after the March on Washington in 1963. So we're still seeing all this like violence that continues to happen. And even in 2023, we still see it. So again, going through that historiography. So those are some things to expect for November 20th, TDOR.
Talk to me about, and this is something that I'm interested even for myself. You have I want to get the proper language, founder and instructor of the Trans Excellence Academy, where you offer transgender empathy trainings.
Yes.
Boy, we need that.
Thank you so much. Yes, that is correct. So after, you know, meeting with the incredible community of Los Angeles and throughout the state of California, another comment that was given to me not only was the violence and lack of representation, but also the fact that medical providers, as we go into our medical transitions, right, or even our educators, there's still a lot of, as we know, injustices in the school systems for our youth and young people. So I was getting a lot of this feedback and focus groups and surveys and stuff. And I was like, how can I be the change that I want to see? And as a former teacher, I actually taught openly as a trans teacher from 2014 until 2019 in Jacksonville, Florida. This was before Don't Say Gay. This was before, you know, it's interesting. One of my brothers was like, hey, do you think because you came in there openly teaching as trans, now they're like, you know, like, you know, shook some stuff up, girl. Now they put on us like, don't say that, you know. But, you know, at the same time, like, you know, I am honored to say that I did not have that pushback during my teaching years. But all of that compelled me to create transgender empathy trainings. And that was launched in September of 2021. We presented at the National Latin X Conference, Black Trans Advocacy Conference, Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. So these are the people who are like the superintendents and over public health. And so there was some pushback, you know, even in Los Angeles, you know, you have people like, we don't like the term cisgendered. And but all of that was important to make sure that our community understands that it's empathy. It's understanding that this language is important to make sure that we're connecting with all community members and we're willing to meet people where they're at. So that's why I continue to do that as well.
How can we get folks involved in that who aren't in Los Angeles? Is it a hybrid presentation?
You got it. Absolutely. So I do have a website as well. And the website is linked to both a hateful homicide and transgender empathy trainings. So you can type in a hatefulhomicide.net. And I'll also send you the link as well too, Angel. So that way, if you want to share it later, you can post it up. But also that link does include a / trans empathy trainings. The trainings nice. Are hybrid. I'm gladly to do remote trainings, especially for those who aren't in California. It's $500 an hour. And that's just because for me as a Black trans woman of lived experience, I just want to make sure that, you know, not only am I putting in my professional, standards and qualifications, but I'm also putting in my lived experience too, mm-hmm. which can also mm-hmm. come from a place of vulnerability and emotionally draining. So I'm just making sure that, you know, I'm making sure I'm being fair to everyone on the board of yeah. organizations that, but absolutely. And the training is typically 2 hours, but you don't have to do the full 2 hours. You can certainly do 1 hour, 1 month, and then we can pick up on the second hour, you know, another time, if whatever is economically feasible for you and your organizations.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time. I will be out there on the 20th. Rita Hester has this magnificent mural in Alston near where she lived for a number of years. It's incredible. And I know how truly beloved she was. So to see her immortalized that way is pretty incredible. And I do want to say this before we wrap, that directly in relation to Rita's murder and the way that she and people like her were depicted in the media, that organizations have since prepared and released their own guides, particularly for journalists, for talking about folks in the community. And it's pretty impressive. And I certainly will share it when everything goes up online. They established this for journalists, and I think probably some of the most pressing information on that is recognize how that person lived and how the people around them spoke of them. Once I discovered that, I felt a tiny bit better about the progress that we've been able to make, but I still find the language, and I'm somebody who has worked in commercial radio for well over 20 years, more years than I care to mark. We've all been guilty of this kind of language. And for some of us, it's because we didn't know better. But now we have opportunities to know better. And now it's up to us to figure out what's next.
Agreed. And absolutely. And what does that look like for you, Angel, in terms of what's next for our community, in terms of just growing and glowing? And what does mm-hmm. that look like for you?
Talking about it. Not feeling like, oh, if I talk about the LGBTQ plus community, am I going to offend somebody else? I'm not really too worried about offending someone who feels like they're more superior to other people, or people who are in this community are inferior to them. We're all human beings, and we need to recognize one another in that way. But what I have found first and foremost, and I'm not that person that says, I have a gay friend. I do have gay friends. I have a Black friend. I do have Black friends. Until you have the experience of knowing someone and actually seeing how they live their lives and how they walk in those shoes, you may not fully realize what this kind of life is. It has not been an easy life. For a lot of people, there are a lot of people in various parts of the country and the world that this is still a very difficult life. We need to have more compassion than that. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot at stake here. There's a lot of violence still.
Absolutely. No, agree with you 100%. And that's what it's about, right? Compassion, empathy, mm-hmm. the growth mindset, right? If we can get into that growth mindset and where we see like, okay, it's not about like a binary identity, or it's not about, you know, a racial identity. It's about just seeing people as people and let them show up as they are. And, you know, what they say, if it's not hurting anyone, you know, why let it get to you? And also, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. You know, just let people live, let them enjoy their lives. Because I think the pandemic, if anything, should have taught us life. Mm-hmm. The pandemic affected each and every one of us. It did not have a specific group. It didn't have a specific, you know, gender identity target. Right. It was everyone, anyone. All of us were, you know, shocked and scared. So I hope those kind of, I think that we have to look at kind of the meaning of life and like, these are our wake up calls. ourselves, right? Like, life is short. We all can be impacted by global pandemics. We all can be impacted by social distancing. These are things that we can all relate to. And so why not, when as these things are starting to lessen, let's come back into the world a little kinder. Let's come back into the world a little bit more empathetic and stop, you know, coming back into that same mindset of bigotry and ignorance and discrimination, because it's not getting us anywhere.
That's good advice, because we are rolling into the holiday season where a fair amount of folks are going to have to be face to face with some of those people.
Treat people the way you want to be treated. You know, 'tis the season to be jolly. You know, I mean, I think the messaging is in everything that we do, right? Like, I mean, it goes without, like, you know, tis the season, be jolly. You know, again, like, you ask what we can do. If you see someone who, and again, we never want to assume anyone's identity or, you know, anyone's, you know, truth. But if you see someone that maybe, you know, you question if they are of the trans experience, you know, maybe they're looking for that same Christmas present as you. You know, maybe give a little grace on Black Friday shopping, you know, be like, okay, you know what? Not because of pity or we're just showing a little jolliness and grace.
You wrapped it up very succinctly, Mallory. Let's give a little grace.
Thank you so much, my friend. And I appreciate your time, and take care.
Thank you. Everything about Mallory Jenna Robinson, A Hateful Homicide, Trans Empathy Training, and more, you can start at ahatefulhomicide.net. On the site for TDOR and Remembering Our Dead, there is a Google Doc that I found containing the names of hundreds of people, 344 of which, 344 of which were from the United States. And what it shows is their name, their location, the date they died, and their cause of death. All of whom were people who shared a transgender identity. Some are unnamed. Some are listed as unknown man wearing a dress in Hollywood, California in 1991, died of multiple gunshot wounds. There's someone listed as unknown transsexual in Long Beach, California, November 6th, 2004. And the names from Massachusetts. Denise Puglisi, Brighton, Massachusetts, January 1st, 1979. There's somebody listed as unknown person dressed in women's clothing that was murdered in Boston in 1979. Georgette Hart, Charlestown, Massachusetts, 1980. Monique Rogers, Boston, Massachusetts, August 3rd, 1986. Diane Carter, Boston, September 16th, 1986. Deborah Forte, Haverhill, Massachusetts, May 15th, 1995. Chanel Pickett, Watertown, November 20th, 1995. Rita Hester, Boston, November 28th, 1998. Monique Thomas, Dorchester, September 11th, 1998. Lisa Daniels, Dorchester, September 17th, 2005. Now, the information can't be completely accurate. There are many factors at play. The most obvious is how that murder has been reported. Is a transgender woman being listed as a male John Doe, like Rita Hester was? It's all very troubling. But like Mallory said, couldn't we just give some grace? Thank you for listening. My name is Angel Wood. This is Crime of the Truest Kind, online at crimeofthetruestkind.com. Follow the show at Crime of the Truest Kind. Yes, I love 5-star reviews. They are my favorite. Drop a tip in the jar. I got a lot of dogs. Apparently, I might need to buy a new pair of headphones because Poppy ate the cord. Support the show. Patreon.com. 5 tiers starting at $1. Thank you to our brand new Patreon supporters, Wicked Cool, Mac Duncan and Roberta, Solid Gold Devin, Pam K, Deborah, Superstars, Lisa McColgan, Rhiannon, Devil Dog, I got your email. I can't recall if I sent you a response yet. Thank you, everyone. I did send out a couple rounds of thank you packages for new patrons and people who requested some merch, so I hope you got them. Happy Thanksgiving. My wish for you is that you get to spend the holiday with the people you most want to spend it with. Last thing before I go. By the time I speak to you again, I should know the date or dates to our next live events. I got live video feed from the show at Off Cabot. I have a plan for it, so check your Patreon. I haven't watched it yet. I might not watch it. All right, I must be going. Take care of yourselves and lock your goddamn doors.